Wow, well, that's as good as it gets. So I think we should go to the bar now. It's fantastic to see so many of you here tonight. I have to say, when it was announced that I was doing this lecture, I did wonder whether it might just be me and my dog Jolly here tonight. But there's no room for him. So I see a lot of familiar faces, but I see a lot of new faces as well. So if you don't know me, my name's Marcus. Can you hear me all right at the back, by the way? Yeah, good. So my name's Marcus Stone. I'm a personal coach, and I'm also trainer of the presence module for the Animas Transformational Diploma in Coaching. What is this lecture about? It's an interesting question. And when Nick asked me if I wanted to do this lecture, I jumped at the opportunity, partly because it's just a great opportunity, but also because it seemed like it was just such a long way away at that time. And that was true. That was definitely true in terms of distance and time, because at the time, Nick and I were trekking in Nepal on the way to Everest Base Camp. So the distance was there and the time was there. But as time has a habit of doing, it moves inexorably on. And I found myself, not that long ago, feeling a little bit unsettled that I didn't have a huge amount to talk about. I had a vague idea that I wanted to... there was something about Carl Rogers' six necessary and sufficient conditions for change. I understand this at a theoretical level and perhaps also an experiential level from my own coaching practice. But there was something underneath this. I just wondered, why is it that these conditions work? Now, those of you who've been through the presence module for me know that I bang on about this quite a lot. Those of you who haven't yet been through it, well, that pleasure is all yours to come. And it talks really about how the coach is congruent and authentic and shows unconditional positive regard and empathy. But there's something that lies behind there for me, something at a really human level that speaks to why it is that these conditions work. And Carl Rogers says, if all of these conditions are present, then change will happen. Not that it might happen, that it will happen. So there was a vague interest for me in that. But the thing that really unlocked it for me was a chance conversation that I had with a friend over lunch one day. And she told me about something that had happened to her just a few days before. And I'd like to share that story with you if I can. So she was going away on a management team conference with her organization. It was an overnight stay. And she had arrived and she was checking into her room when she got a text message on her phone telling her that a friend who had been seriously ill had actually just passed away. Now, the timing of this for her was unexpected, and so it was quite shocking. And she was expected to go down to dinner with her team. So she found her boss and a couple of work colleagues, and she explained to them what had happened and said, I just need a bit of time to get myself together. And so that was fine. And when she was ready, she went down, and she joined the 20 or so colleagues in the room. Now, her boss had spoken to the CEO of the organization and told him what had happened. And as she walked in, he made a very expansive and welcoming gesture, indicating for her to go and speak to him. And he spoke to her about this, and they had a conversation. And during this, the whole conversation, he held her hand. Now, I'm going to pause the story there for a minute, because I think this is, for me, it felt quite unusual and it felt quite interesting. But I'd be really interested to know from you, what comes up for you when you hear that? What kind of things are coming up in your mind? And what do you think might have been the outcome and the consequences of that action? So I'd just like you to take a few minutes just to turn to the person or the people next to you and just have a conversation about what is coming up in your mind about that action of holding hands in that space. So let me fill you in on what actually happened and how my friend felt. So before she went into the room, she told me that she felt vulnerable, awkward, and uncomfortable. But there, during the conversation and afterwards, she felt cared for and comforted. She felt she had permission and space to be upset, and her grief was acknowledged and validated. And her feelings were acknowledged. She acknowledged that the contact was unusual, But lovely were the words that she used around that. It was releasing for her. And also she felt that he was with her, not as a boss, but as a human being. So I think there's something interesting there. I think we can recognize from what we've said tonight that it was an unusual thing to do, particularly in the context of a work environment and culturally also. And it was a risk, and there were potentially some sort of uncomfortable outcomes around that. But actually, it was a risk that was worth taking, and it created a moment for my friend of understanding and acceptance and beauty. Well, the question for me is, how did that moment happen? How did he know in that moment that that was what she was needed, that was what she needed? Was it some kind of known knowledge? Was there something that he understood about human beings innately that made him in advance know that this was something that would be acceptable? Or was it something unknown, something that happened in the moment, in an instant, perhaps a moment of instinct, perhaps a moment of intuition, that he just knew in that moment that this was the right thing to do? So what I'd like to do tonight is explore what that might mean on both sides, if I can. So the lecture might get a little bit turgid here. May not be quite what Nick was expecting. So on the known side, what I'd like to do is perhaps try and see whether a better understanding of what our basic human needs are might inform us in our coaching to understand better perhaps some of the things that our clients need and that they don't even recognise that they need. And maybe working around needs that are not met. What does that mean for our clients when our basic needs aren't being met? How would that make us feel? And how might we go about helping our clients so that they can achieve those basic needs? So I did quite a lot of research into, I knew there was some information out there around theories and approaches to basic human needs. But when I started my research, I was slightly taken aback by just how much stuff there is out there. So this is very much a top-down overview of some of the information I found out there, with a view perhaps to sort of just pointing you in the direction if this is something that might interest you, and to give us maybe an opportunity to draw some conclusions at the end as to what some of these human needs are and what they might mean. So, who's heard of Henry Murray and the System of Needs? Nobody. Good. That makes me feel better because neither have I. So back in 1938, this is the earliest thing that I came across. Now, what do we know about this? I know nothing about it. But basically, this describes personality in terms of needs. And the need is defined as the potentiality or readiness to respond in a certain way under certain given circumstances. There was a recognition that needs are presented in varying degrees in individuals, and this leads to uniqueness of character. Now, he categorised them into five basic categories. The first was ambition, and we have achievement, exhibition, and recognition. Materialistic, we have acquisition, construction, order, and retention. Power, which is abasement, autonomy, aggression, blame avoidance, deference, and dominance. And affection, which is nurturance, play, rejection, and succorance. What on earth does all that mean? Well, I don't know. And I was quite relieved to read that this was influential in its time, and it did lead to further understanding and studies. But it was criticised for being very broad-based, and the research was largely subjective. So I'm going to leave that behind, and I'm going to move on next to Abraham Maslow and the hierarchy of needs. Now, who's heard of this one? Okay. Good. Excellent. So had I, amazingly enough. Now, this is a motivational theory, and the idea is that individuals are motivated to achieve something when their basic needs are not being met. So this might be the kind of representational diagram that you are familiar with. The idea is that it's a hierarchy, and there are various stages, and that these lower needs need to have been met before you can go on and satisfy the needs above. So down here, it says physiological. These are basically survival needs at the basic level: breathing, food, water, sex, excellent for reproduction, sleep. It talks about excretion. It probably is a basic human need. I think that was highlighted for me on my trek to Nepal, but I'm not going to talk about that now. So next is safety needs. So here we're talking about security, maybe having a secure home to live in, and the family and employment. What resources do we have? Up above that is love and belonging. So we're talking relationships here. This is a theme that will come out all night, I think. Friendship, family is on about sex again, sexual intimacy. It's a good job we haven't got Libby in the room tonight. So that's that one. Then women, these are all deficiency needs, by the way, these lower four. This is next one is esteem. So here we're talking about self-esteem. We're moving up this hierarchy. How can we get help, self-esteem? What needs do we have around that? Sense of achievement, a sense of self-respect and worth. The respect of others and respect by others. And then finally at the top is self-actualization. Now, Maslow did a lot of work on self-actualization and a lot of studies into what the characteristics of self-actualized people are. Here we're talking about fulfillment, of reaching your full potential in life. And this was something that was recognized by Carl Rogers as well. One of his defining principles was a tendency of people to move towards self-actualization. Now, I like this one because it's sort of quite easy, isn't it, really? It's logical, it's clear, it's relatable. I think most people can relate to this, and the idea is quite clear. And it's also represented pictorially, so it's something that you can remember. It's been criticized subsequently because it had a qualitative rather than a quantitative approach to research. And some of the samples of the research that he used, the people that he spoke to, were biased. He tended to choose people himself, perhaps who he thought might meet his own criteria. And also the idea that it's you move up and you have to satisfy these lower criteria first before you can move up has also been criticized and to some extent shown not to be true. Actually, there's an example from my own coaching which might illustrate that. I've been coaching a lady about loss, and she came to me because she wanted to move on with her life after a period of grieving, and she felt that she was stuck because of that. But in our work, what we uncovered was that she'd actually moved home and that she had issues in her relationship at home with her family and her mum in particular, and also the fact that she'd moved home meant that she felt a bit trapped. She'd lost that independence. But what we realised, what we came to understand, was that this was the key to unlock everything for her, that she needed to sort out that relationship first, and that would then probably unlock that and then hopefully lead her to move on up the chain. All right. Any questions or observations so far? No, stunned silence. Excellent. Okay, now we're moving on to something called ERG theory. Clayton Alderfer, and we've moved on to 1969. Now, this is really a consolidation of the ideas of Maslow and a simplification. He had three, which are the letters ERG, so existence. And this was the material and physiological needs of Maslow, the first two levels. Then there's relatedness, so again, this idea of relationships and contact and connectedness and belonging, social and external esteem as well, and relationships. So the third and fourth levels of Maslow's hierarchy. And then finally, growth, encompassing levels four and five of self-esteem and self-actualization. So quite a simple representation there. There was an acknowledgement here that the lower levels don't have to be met in order to move on and deal with the higher levels. And again, that this is different for everybody. Different people have different needs in different amounts. He was also, I think, probably the first person who started using this to investigate the link between financial reward and motivation, and why perhaps it's not as obvious as we might think. And there are definitely circumstances where financial reward doesn't actually motivate people as we might think. We are not as manipulable and predictable as people might think. So now, gosh, who's heard of self-determination theory? Oh, Nick has nightmare. Okay. Right. So SDT. I have to be careful in what order I get those letters. Edward Deci and Richard Ryan in the mid-1980s. So what do we know about this? It's a theory of motivation, personality, and optional functioning. And it seems quite simple. There are three innate psychological needs considered as universal necessities. And they are competence, a desire to control and master our environment and to know outcomes. And for me, that speaks as well of certainty. That's my little bit at the end there. And certainty in this instance around what we can control. Our need for certainty around what we can control and how might we achieve that. The question that comes into my mind is, which isn't addressed here, I don't think, what about certainty over things that we can't control? So I'll come on to that a little bit later. Next is relatedness again. So again, we have this, this idea about our contact with other people, our desire to interact with and connect to others and belonging, and finding our tribe. So we might see the Animas community as a tribe. I certainly do. A tribe filled with like-minded people where I love to spend my time. How much do you have a need for that in your life and your clients? And where is it not being met? And how might you achieve that? And then autonomy. So this, I rushed through the Murray stuff earlier, but interestingly, this is the first time since Murray that autonomy has shown up. So a sense of free will and self-direction in line with our interests and values. And I've written there freedom and flexibility because I recognise this is really important for me personally. I spent a long career, as many of you will know, in property, and it was a very it felt very fixed and rigid to me, and I really didn't feel that I had any autonomy within that role in what I could do. And I've spent the last 3 or 4 years gradually unwinding that to the extent that last year, in the summer, I had a lot of freedom and flexibility and autonomy. I felt that to a large extent I could choose the work that I wanted to do and when I could do it. And I felt free and happy as a result. But then September came around and a phone call, somebody offered me a position back in property, which I was interested in for some strange reason. And it was a 12-month contract. I negotiated it down to 3 days a week. And what has it done? It's really brought into focus that that is a very important need of mine. And it is now not being met in the way that I would like it to be. It's 3 days in the middle of the week where I don't feel I've got any kind of autonomy in the role at all. But interestingly, the bits outside that, I don't feel I've got autonomy there either because it's pushed everything to the sides and it means that I have to do stuff at times when perhaps I would rather not. So then it goes on and it talks about different types of motivation and it talks about intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. So intrinsic motivation, we're doing something for the love of it because we want to. It comes from inside us. And extrinsic motivation, we're doing something for a separate reason, for something that's outside of us, perhaps. So an example might be two people going for a cycle ride. One person is doing it because they've got a goal to lose weight or get healthy, and that is an extrinsic motivation, whereas the other person might be going along for the ride simply because they love cycling, and they're doing it simply for the sake of that. They might get the benefit of the health as well, but those are the differences. I'm not going to talk too much more about this other than to say that it's a well-respected theory. There's a huge amount of information out there on it and lots of studies have come out of it. And it really shows that humans are endlessly complex and that something that might motivate one person might not motivate another. And so that's important, I think, for us to recognise as coaches that our clients are all individuals. And, you know, what does motivate them? What are their basic needs? So one of the things that it does talk about and shows money as a motivator, and what this theory has proved or shown is that if you have a basic task, a basic physical task that doesn't require any creativity or thought, then money is a motivator. It's a direct motivator. But once you add in any kind of creativity or thought into that, then that link is often broken. And that money is not the motivator that we might think it is. Now, There is something around taking money off the table. So paying people enough that they don't think about money in terms of their needs and survival. But once you've done that, then there's a lot of other things that come into play that motivate people in the workplace or in their lives. And that's just worth thinking about. And it all ties in with that kind of intrinsic and extrinsic motivation. Okay, so that led me to thinking about certainty again and this idea about what about certainty about things that we can't control. And so I think maybe the biggest one of these things for me would be death. So unless actually we choose to take our lives, then death is generally outside our control. And how people look for certainty around things that they can't control. So for example, people might have beliefs around death that allow them to have a certain certainty about that process. So some people might believe that this is your life and that's it. Once you die, that's it. Another set of people will believe in reincarnation. The idea that how you behave in your life will dictate how and when and why you're reincarnated, and maybe there's rewards in place if you live a good life. Other people might consider that we are infinite beings experiencing an earthbound life here and now, but actually our souls and our spirits are infinite. And how might that impact the way that we live? So that led me to look for certainty as a basic human need and came up with this scarf model from David Rock, 2008. I'm going to sort of rattle through these. I feel that I'm talking too much here. So the first one that he had was status, relative importance to others. That's come up before. Then certainty. So that's why it came up for me. Our being able to predict the future. So I think there's something important around that. And for me, what if our clients are clinging to that certainty? And it becomes not only their truth, but it becomes the truth. And maybe they get dogmatic around their beliefs in their need for certainty. Then how helpful is that for our clients if this truth becomes overwhelming for them? Is it positive for them in their lives? What will that mean for them? What is it that's stopping them being open to the possibility of other people's beliefs? Autonomy. Yay, my favourite. There it is again. Our sense of control over events. Relatedness, again, that comes up again and again. And finally, fairness, which is something that hasn't come up before, I don't think, really. So our perception of fair exchanges with other people. And I think that's an interesting one. So what if you've got a client who is constantly talking about unfair situations in conversations they have either with people at home or at work? And for me, that speaks of expectations. So I would want to know, what is your expectation of this outcome? And why is that expectation falling short and you're feeling that this is unfair, either a conversation or actions of others against you? And also there's something around, if this is due to an interaction, you're feeling unfair because of an interaction, then have you looked at it from the other side? What is the other person's position and stance on this? And maybe an understanding of where they're coming from and an empathy to their position might actually help you to get a slightly better handle on what is fair and what is not, and perhaps a more realistic view of that. And you might use something like perceptual positioning to explore something like that with your clients. And finally, you'll be glad to hear, my list, I was actually directed to this. Who's heard of human givens therapy? Okay, just a few wise souls at the back of the room. So I'd never heard of this one either. Human givens therapy. Joe Griffin and Ivan Turrell from 1996, and I think this is rather lovely. It really appealed to me. The missing heart of positive psychology. So something human into the scientific exploration of positive psychology. Now this is neuroscience-based, biology-based, and psychology-based, and it's well-researched. And actually studies into this therapy have generally been very positive. It's a set of organising ideas around providing a scientific framework for understanding the way that individuals and societies work. Now, they split it into physical and emotional needs. The physical ones are fairly straightforward. I'm just going to deal with the emotional ones. And the things that they have here are security, attention, giving and receiving. Autonomy, again. Emotional intimacy. Belonging to a wider community. Maybe that tribe thing. Privacy. Now, that's an interesting one that hasn't come up before. So the idea that whilst we recognise that we want to belong to wider communities and interact with people, that also we may have a need for privacy, space on our own, space to reflect and for inner thought. Status in social groupings, a sense of competence and achievement, and meaning and purpose. And those are the principal elements of human givens therapy. Now, there's loads more out there, honestly. There's consistency theory. There's Anthony Robbins, the coach, has devised his own list of things. So there's lots of stuff out there. So I think there is a consensus and a large weight of evidence around the link between satisfaction of basic human needs and well-being, mental health, motivation, and change. So what I've done is produce my consolidated list of basic human needs. So I've looked at all of those things that I've talked about tonight, and I've tried to make sense of it and also see which bits resonate with me. Now, this is none of my own work, and I'm standing on the shoulders of giants in presenting this list, but here we go. Safety and certainty. So are we safe enough or are we too safe? So if we're not safe enough in our lives and we feel uncomfortable, why is that and how can we change that? Or are we too safe? Are we telling ourselves that we need this safety around us, but actually we're firmly in our comfort zone? Or as I like to call it, the missing out on life zone. What if you're stuck or your clients are stuck in that zone and they don't recognise it? And actually it might benefit them to step out and see what's beyond it. Uncertainty, the flip side. So we talk about the need for safety and certainty, but what about uncertainty? What about our need for a bit of variety, risk, and excitement in our life? And how does that play with that? And where does the balance need to lie for your clients as individuals? Relatedness and connection comes up every time, and it obviously is incredibly important to others' spheres of life and belonging. And that's, you know, all our relationships, whether it's friends and family, work, wider communities. Self-esteem, ideas around validation, acceptance, worth, and self-respect. Autonomy, had to be in there. Sense of free will and choice and self-direction. Purpose, meaning, growth, and fulfillment. And that produces quite a catchy acronym there. SERPSK. Actually, I think there's another one. There we go. So I knew there was a SERPSK. I might need to work on that one a bit. So contribution. So there's an idea. Contribution. What if you were to contribute freely to something that you loved and to somebody that you loved or a community that you loved? Then that contribution could add to your esteem, your self-esteem and your esteem among others, your autonomy because you did it with your free will, your purpose because you're giving it to something that you believe in, and relatedness, because you'll be helping other people in doing it. So I think there may be something there in contribution. Right, where am I going next? I have no idea. Actually, I need your help a little bit. I think what I'd like to do is find out from you, having seen all of that, just some ideas perhaps about how we might use that in our coaching with clients. How might we use a knowledge of basic human needs? Or has anybody got a coaching client at the moment where they think something around that knowledge might help them? Okay, so what I want to do is move on now. And I want to go back to this idea of the known and the unknown. So if we've explored what it is that he might have known in advance that led him to take that action to hold her hand, confident that it was going to produce the result he wanted, what if it wasn't? What if it was completely unknown and it just happened in the moment? What if it was a moment of instinct or intuition? Then what does that mean for us as coaches? So, intuition. Who wants to have a crack at defining what intuition means for them? What is intuition? Yeah.
Gut feeling.
Gut feeling. Look at that. Brilliant. Okay, and we also might call it a hunch, inspiration, instinct, something around a sixth sense as well. So in defining it, I've got a couple of definitions from dictionaries. Your intuition, this is from the Collins Dictionary, your intuitions are unexplained feelings you have that something is true even if you have no evidence or proof of it. And then from the Oxford Dictionary, the ability to understand something instinctively without the need for conscious reasoning. So where does intuition come from? Now, I'm going to explore a couple of schools of thought here, one from the scientific community and one from the spiritual community, and see where we might go. So the first is this idea of tacit knowledge, the idea that this is the seen, that it's explicit knowledge and learning, and that it's in our conscious, but that under here is the unseen. It's tacit knowledge and learning. It's implicitly taken on board, and it's in our subconscious. And this idea that everything that happens in our life, actions, words, feelings, all sorts of things, are stored away in our subconscious, ready to emerge at the right moment, or maybe the wrong moment. And then the second scientific explanation is around something called limbic resonance. And this is a capacity for sharing deep emotional states and other non-verbal communications from the limbic areas of our brain. States include dopamine circuit-promoted feelings of empathic harmony, but it can also include feelings of anger, anxiety, and states like that. And it may be that this leads... It's not just human beings, by the way. It's all mammals have this capacity to have limbic resonance. And it may well lead to empathic and intuitive thoughts when we're close to somebody that we care for. But if we move on to the spiritual world, then there's something called the Akashic Records, which we might consider, otherwise known as the Book of Life. This idea that there is a storehouse, a vast library of everything, every human experience that has ever happened in the history of human life. And it's believed to be encoded in the non-physical etheric plane. And that this storehouse, this vast wealth of knowledge, is available to all of us. And it can be felt by each of us. Then we might have the concept of the higher self. It's a higher being outside of yourself, not tethered by this earthly experience. And it's a total soul consciousness. And you can get in touch with that higher self, maybe through meditation, and you can receive information and knowledge which can be channeled directly to you. And maybe that explains intuition. And then finally, I've got spirit guides and guardian angels. This idea that non-corporeal beings are assigned to you either for your lifetime or for parts of your life, and they're able to advise you and help you at certain points of your life. And you might receive messages or information or feelings from them at certain points. So just a quick show of hands in the room. Who is more inclined to the scientific explanations of intuition? Okay. Who might be more inclined towards the spiritual side? Okay. And is there anybody who just doesn't really know and is open to everything?
I'm more the mammal thing.
You're the what?
I'm more the mammal thing.
Right, yeah. Thank you. Now, why have I put that up? So what I want to do is mix the room up a little bit and get a conversation going around intuition. So what I'd like you to do is, if you have a preference for dogs over cats, then come and join me towards the front of the room. If you have a preference for cats over dogs, I'm banishing you to the back of the room without giving away my preference. And if you don't really mind, then you might stay somewhere in the middle, okay? So organize yourselves. Okay. So when you have found your place and your tribe, what I want you to do is just have a discussion around intuition and how you experience intuition. So maybe have a conversation about an intuitive moment that you've had. You can gather into small groups, not one big group, so find two or three people to have this conversation with. And a moment of intuition you've had, either just in your life or in your coaching, and how did you experience it? So just for a few minutes, thank you. Okay. I'm going to just read out a few quotes. The first one from Henri Poincaré. I'm not sure I got that right. It is through science that we prove, but through intuition that we discover. Albert Einstein said, I believe in intuitions and inspirations. I sometimes feel that I am right. I do not know that I am. And finally, from Malcolm Gladwell, insight is not a light bulb that goes off inside our heads. It's a flickering candle that can be easily snuffed out. And for me, that's a really interesting quote. And if there's something around that, that intuition is this delicate thing that can be smothered, it reminds me that when I was doing the research on the basic human needs, how overwhelmed I felt by the weight of that knowledge that I carried around with me. I felt that I needed to have an understanding of it so that I could deliver it in a semi-logical sense to you tonight. And it was quite overwhelming. And I think that as coaches, and particularly as students, sometimes the learning and the studying that we do, can become a little bit overwhelming. And that maybe we want to take those tools into our coaching sessions and demonstrate for our clients, and that maybe we put pressure on ourselves around success and failure. What if intuition can be snuffed out by just the consciousness, our own consciousness, of what we know, or what we think we know, or perhaps even what we think we ought to know? And what if the weight of knowledge and the subsequent pressure that we put on ourselves and our clients might put on us in order to demonstrate our expertise in the coaching space, that might smother any intuitive emergence? What if the CEO had allowed a thought to come into his head in that moment that stopped him holding my friend's hand? A thought around, well, I can't do that. It's completely inappropriate in this space and all my work colleagues are around. Well, firstly, I'd have had nothing to talk about tonight. And secondly, my friend, well, she would have missed out potentially on that moment of magic and healing for her. And it makes me wonder for us as coaches, how many of those moments that we might miss because we carry that weight of knowledge around. And then perhaps I've got rather a strange question. What if it's better if we know nothing? Now, that might be an odd question to ask when I'm standing here lecturing for a school of coaching where we teach things. And I think the thing for me is that learning is obviously beneficial and all of it goes in. But if we carry all of that learning and knowledge into the coaching space and we put pressure on ourselves, it might smother our ability to be instinctive and intuitive. How can we find a way to perhaps leave that knowledge to one side and go in as if we know nothing? And allow that intuition to emerge for us in the space, knowing that it will be there at the right time. Okay, I'm conscious that I need a drink. I don't know about the rest of you. So I'm just going to rattle through the rest of it. So exercising and developing intuition. Some of the things that you can find to do. This is listening to your body. A lot of people get a sense of intuition through their body. Gut feel. It's a felt sense. Notice the non-behavioural non-verbal behaviour of others. So perhaps in social environments, just notice what it is that people are doing and see what that means for you. Try to make some sense of their hand movements, eye movements, body posture, etc. Follow hunches. Learn to trust your instincts and your intuition. Embrace quietness. That's really worked for me. Find 5 or 10 minutes a day to take yourself off and sit somewhere quiet and just be with yourself. And finally, practicing self-awareness. Oh, not finally. And be more spontaneous. Yep, that was finally. Excellent. Okay, potential pitfalls of intuition for coaches. Well, I think there's a big one. I think there's a danger that we might start to believe our own shit, actually, and think of ourselves as intuitive, and maybe label ourselves as intuitive coaches. And in that sense, maybe we start to get a sense of superiority, a sense that our intuition is always right, and that we've got something to tell our clients. And you might end up being a slight in a guru state. There's nothing wrong with gurus, but perhaps being a guru coach might be slightly challenging in the way that we describe coaching at Animas. So I would say to you, treat your intuition lightly, learn to develop it, see what it means for you, and find a way of offering your intuition. If you think it might have something for your clients, offer it as a gift for them, but remain unattached to the outcome of that offer. And if it doesn't resonate with your clients, then be prepared to let it go. And finally, I can't actually remember what this is. I think this is something around, yes, at its very basic level, even if this is all that you do as a coach, I think the basic things that people need when they come to see me as a coach sometimes are simply to be listened to be understood, and to be thought well of. And if you can wrap love and compassion around your work and the people that you work with, I think the magic of coaching will emerge. And that's it from me. I'd just like to thank you for being here.